Good morning, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Kate Flannery, and I'm the Executive Director of the Community Engagement of Syracuse University, and I will be your moderator today. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge, with respect, the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the Indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Thursday Morning Roundtable is a weekly public forum hosted by Syracuse University's Office of Community Engagement that features prominent newsmakers who discuss current events in Central New York and beyond. I have the distinct pleasure to introduce our guest speaker today, Randy Wolkin. Randy is the president and CEO of MACNE, the Manufacturers Association, which serves over 300 companies that employ more than 50,000 people within a 26-county region in Central and Upstate New York. He is the president and CEO of the Manufacturers Alliance of New York, which is a coalition of manufacturing groups representing over 2,500 companies and over 425,000 manufacturing employees through New York State. Mr. Wolkin joined MACNE in 2001 and has dedicated over 20 years to improving the business climate in Central New York and Upstate. Prior to joining MACNE, Mr. Wolkin served as the executive director of the Samaritan Center, worked as a senior budget analyst in the Division of Management and Budget for Onondaga County Government in Syracuse, New York, and served as an officer on active duty at both Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York, and Fort Drum in Watertown, New York. Mr. Wolkin holds a Bachelor of Science degree from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and a Master's in Public Administration degree from the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. He has too many awards and recognize all of them. He has been a true treasure to our community, and it's with great pleasure that I welcome Randy at this time.
Thanks, Kate. And it's nice to see many of you. I'm looking forward to seeing you all again in person as we continue to transition into, I will call it living with COVID, you know, in a safe way. So I'm looking forward to talking today about a really important topic, actually two important topics in particular. One, manufacturing, which as you have heard, has been my work for over 20 years now. And what's going on in New York State related to manufacturing in the country. And then to talk about our most critical crisis, which is an international incident, obviously, the invasion of the Ukraine. I'll talk about how they intersect and, of course, take your questions and hopefully have a dialogue on it as well. So I'm coming to you from my home office. Many of us do this these days, right? Where we get out of bed and we walk 25 feet and start our work. That's one of the big changes that we've seen with the pandemic. So what I wanted to do is just spend some time talking about how we got here. And, you know, what we saw, of course, due to COVID was a significant downturn in the economy, a massive shift in our economic growth. And this is on par with the 2009 financial crisis. So you can see just how deep the recession was. And of course, from an employment standpoint, we saw a massive reduction in employment in many industries. Can I go to my next slide, please? The industries most affected by the pandemic, of course, were leisure and hospitality. The unemployment rate was as much as almost 40%. Manufacturing itself saw about a 13% unemployment rate. Just about every sector of the economy saw a significant downturn. What that, of course, did was distress firms, those very entities that employ people. And we did see a much greater amount of distress. And really, even those industries did see a rapid uptick, the hotel and food. When it came to manufacturing, as you can see, it was actually less than 10% of firms actually saw significant financial distress. And they expected to see upside recovery. And that's happening as we speak. How long will it take to return to the pre-pandemic employment rates? As you can see, depending on where you were in the globe and how much you were impacted by COVID-19. When it came to the US, we don't expect to see pre-pandemic employment rates to be as high as they were prior to the pandemic until the end of 2023. The Eurozone, which probably will be infected by this crisis, was going to see it much sooner. One of the most significant impacts it had all of our lives, just walk around your local grocery store, try to go to a car lot today and find a car, a new car that is, Our supply chains were significantly and severely disrupted. And what's interesting is, depending on where you're at, your supply chains were much more disrupted. Like if you look at the Eurozone, you can see just how disruptive the pandemic was. Unfortunately, when it comes to supply chains, those things don't get quickly or easily worked out. And we'll continue to see supply chain challenges. And I believe the crisis in Europe will exacerbate those to some degree. One of the interesting things here, of course, is you notice that China saw almost no real supply chain disruptions. They're a major manufacturing country as we speak, and many of the suppliers and many of their component parts are made right there in China. So they don't have to worry about disruptions. Where US and Eurozone companies get their parts and get their we get our products from all over the globe. So globalization has caused, in some ways, the supply chain disruptions that we're seeing today. And it's not easy to fix. You might say, well, what can we do to fix it? Well, we need about 100,000 truck drivers to begin to address the problem. We can't get the transport from the coast because so much of it's being traded into our grocery stores. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You also have problems with carriers in terms of rail carriers and even platforms for trucks, depending on where they move. It's complicated when you work on a supply chain. Supply chain will be a big problem, significant problem. And it's having what you would imagine. It's causing inflation. It's causing price increases. And that will continue to be the case, we see, at least for the foreseeable future. Likely manageable, but for the foreseeable future. So on top of that, we had last week a massive change in the sort of security or geopolitical dimension of Europe. For the first time since World War II, hit the largest land invasion in Europe. And just to give you a sense of the order of magnitude, you can on the left, as I'm looking at this slide, you'll see NATO. And the Russian Federation is in red, along with the non-aligned countries, Ukraine being one of them. That has grown significantly since the end of World War II. And more countries, even as we speak, are interested now in joining NATO if they're already not a part of the EU. Sweden and Finland, historically being neutral, have now are seriously seeking, or at least considering, joining NATO, which is something you wouldn't have thought of before. So Putin was incredibly concerned about where Ukraine was heading, and he didn't want them to join NATO and the EU exclusively. But the impact may be even greater as more and more countries join NATO. You may have seen even Germany has decided to significantly increase its defense budget in response to this. So a lot of change is going on in Europe based on this invasion. I want to point out just the sheer differences in the armed forces between the Ukraine and Russia. Clearly, Russia has a much larger military force. Compared to NATO, it's still not both in capabilities and size to NATO, but in terms of a single country like the Ukraine, quite significant. But, I can lean a little bit on my military background here as we prepared for the Soviet Union at the time. Its capabilities are actually being called into question. After 7 days, they still have not seized any of the major cities. And of course, warfare in open terrain and warfare in urban environments are radically different. And that's why this war could go on for a long time, especially if the Ukrainian people begin to put up a resistance, which would be insurgency. So we don't know how long this war would continue and what its impacts will be, when it comes to the devastation of war. But right now, the Ukrainian people are not doing what Putin expected, that is a quick collapse, the government fleeing the country, and then being able to install their own regime. Interesting enough, the world opinion is dramatically different as well. And I think this is what Putin did not count on. When he invaded Crimea, the world kind of rolled over and went back to sleep. I think it was probably inappropriate. We should have done something back then because of someone like Putin wants their appetites wet. And they think there won't be any implications, they will continue to advance. That's not been the case this time. Also this time, the economic sanctions are really causing significant challenges. Starting with the invasion of Crimea, then Georgia, related to the separatist areas of Georgia, for instance, the ruble has dramatically inflated. So dollar to ruble in 2012 was 25 rubles to a dollar. Just recently, in some places, it's 117. So the average Russian is seeing a significant inflation, and their power of their rubles are significantly less. So you're seeing runs on the banks in attempt to get cash. You're finding a significant amount of economic hardship that will continue. Now that takes time to have pressure, but that is quite significant. And what makes it different than it would have been 34 years ago, we're so interconnected from a financial standpoint that the hardship will continue for Russia and its citizens. And the real question is how long will the war go on and how long will the economic sanctions hold? But these are all the dynamics of what's going on in Europe. And of course, a lot of concern, fear, and probably inflation. The most significant thing that Russia has, as you've probably been reading around, is oil, its reserves, and its provision of oil and natural gas to Europe is quite significant. If Europe and the world can refrain from buying that oil, they'll quickly run out of their flow of new revenues coming into the country. Just to give you a sense of the size of the Russian economy, it's about the size of Australia's economy. It's not as significant as China or the US. Its export power is not as large or as significant as Germany. What's happened over time, and this is really what caused a lot of the conflict, is this is the Ukraine's export of goods by destination. So in 2012, it was more evenly split between the European Union and the Russian Federation in terms of their exports. By 2018, in terms of the Russian Federation, has significantly decreased in less than 10%, with the European Union rising to almost 45%. So they've already transitioned their economy to being connected with the West, the pro-democracy West. And this is just one of the complaints of Putin in terms of its drift away from. Of course, the great fear was they would join the West, specifically the EU, and would join the NATO. If you're wondering what he's likely to do, I think it's highly unlikely that Russia would invade any of the NATO countries, for example, Poland. That triggers Article 5, which would then cause them to be at war with NATO. And in terms of actual forces and capabilities, NATO is significantly superior to Russia. Now, the Western sanctions, if they can hold in place, it really will strangle the Russian economy. They're not capable. They have to import many of their goods. They're not a manufacturing giant or large producer, especially advanced goods. They have to import those things. They're primarily a raw material provider. And that makes them less likely to be able to sustain their own economy. We'll watch closely to see what China does. China will be a key actor here as well as other major countries that haven't yet weighed in terms of specifically sanctioning the Russians. For example, India is also on the sideline right now. And there's a lot of complicated military and strategic alliances that are being realigned as we speak. But these are all things that are in play right now. As I mentioned, the most significant element to watch will be China. We saw the two of them shake hands and actually form some sort of loose pledge even during the Olympics. In fact, there was quite a bit of prediction that Russia would do something right after the Olympics. That's sort of been their pattern. China is an entirely different type of challenge. And it really is the leading superpower other than the U.S. in the world because of its economic power. They are the second largest economy in the world and rival the U.S., unlike Russia, which is not nearly as economically powerful. Also, the key thing to watch here is what China is looking to do or we'll see come out of this conflict. They don't want to damage their economy. They don't want to lose their economic momentum, but they certainly want Taiwan. Now, Taiwan has a much different impact than Ukraine in terms of the world economy, because in Taiwan, about 80% of the high-end semiconductor chips, things that run cars and tanks and airplanes, are made in Taiwan. And so Taiwan is a much bigger strategic target, both economically and from a national security standpoint, than the Ukraine. There is one element made in the Ukraine, it's a neon that goes into semiconductor production. It's the largest producer of neon in the world. So that would be one critical subcomponent or need of the semiconductor industry that could be harmed by prolonged issues in the Ukraine. I want to shift a little bit to Asia because Asia is where the economic power, I have a slide later on that shows just the economic might of Asia and who has the capabilities within Asia. This is an Asia power index looking at the key countries. As you can see, when it comes to military capacity in Asia, the United States still has the largest military capacity, followed by China. And Russia obviously has a large military capacity, India being there as well. When it comes to resources, the United States is clearly the leader. China is a relatively close second. Russia falls significantly down the list when it comes to impact and influence on Asia. In terms of economic capability in Asia itself, the U.S. And China are essentially the same at the top of the chart with Japan, India. You can see Russia has a relatively small economic capability related to Asia. In terms of resilience, both economics and other, the U.S. is the most resilient economy. In terms of the ability to sustain itself, Russia does have a significant amount of oil supplies. And the challenge, of course, this probably doesn't take into account cutting off its banking system. The banking system is at the heart of everything. As you know, we don't barter with chickens anymore. You need dollars or rubles. And without them, without the flow of those things, your resiliency as an economy and as a nation are dramatically impacted. Now I want to shift my conversation to what's going on specifically in manufacturing with the focus on New York State and Central New York. I will start though at the national picture. The most recent National Association of Manufacturing Outlook survey done at the end of last year showed a very optimistic and positive outlook for manufacturing. And that has continued from what we can see up until the most recent crisis. What we're seeing, all the indicators would suggest growth. There are some, obviously, some challenges when it comes to prices companies are paying, and you'll see that reflected also here in New York State. But a positive outlook generally for manufacturing. We're going to see what kind of significant or meaningful impact that the invasion would have into the Ukraine, but we start out in a strong position. So what happened in New York State? This kind of give you some history. We have not yet regained all the private sector jobs, non-farm or private sector jobs that we once had. But the trend is very positive. In fact, we have significant openings in our member companies. On average, about 10% jobs are open. What's part of what's going on, of course, with COVID, many people just aren't working. So there's a less workforce available. And of course, the jobs that are available and open are tech jobs or higher paying jobs, which are good, but people have to have the skills to have them. To give you a sense of how dramatically the unemployment rates changed in 1 year, this is a June to June look. As you can see in Central New York, we went from almost 11.5% unemployment to about 5.4%. It has continued to improve. So from all practical measures, they sort of say an economy is fully employed in terms of available people in the job market that are looking at about 4%. So we have actually done quite well in recovery. This is true throughout the state. New York State itself, because of New York City, has a little higher unemployment rate than other parts of upstate. So what happened in terms of job gains, you can see this shows you all the different categories. Manufacturing did pick up about almost 15,000 jobs over the last year. Just so you have a sense of the order of magnitude of manufacturing in New York, we're one of the top 10 manufacturing states in the country. So New York is still a very large manufacturing state with a lot of manufacturing output. And a lot of that, most of that's advanced or technologically advanced manufacturing. To give you a sense of sort of what's happened, job gains, just this period of time, I was able to easily pull, again, manufacturing leading, but it didn't see the same decline in jobs that leisure and hospitality did. And that's one of the reasons why that one in particular saw a big significant jump. When it comes to where people work, this has actually stayed very similar throughout the last decade. About 9% of the workforce is directly in manufacturing. Manufacturing is different today. They're much leaner in terms of actually owning things that are not essential to production of the products. So many of those things that would be in other services that would have been under manufacturing in the past. But you can get a sense, this has really stayed relatively stable and stayed stable during the downturn in terms of where people work as a percentage. The highest paid jobs in the community actually are manufacturing, followed by financial services. A typical manufacturing starting job will be anywhere between $40,000, $50,000, or $60,000. And with a full apprenticeship, you can make high 80, 90s and dip into, with special skills, into over 100 grand. Really high paying job. What are the current indicators across New York State? New York Fed does a monthly survey of manufacturers to get a sense of what they see in terms of some specific things. The general business conditions actually have fallen slightly, though they're still positive. And I'll get to future conditions projected as well, but it's still very positive. Whenever you're above zero, you're seeing growth. New orders did drop off somewhat in the last month, but quite frankly, still positive, and shipments remain positive as well. Unfilled orders is quite high. This has some to do with both pricing and supply chain. So the other thing that's impacting the ability to fulfill orders is people. If you're under, if you don't have enough team staff, you can't put product out the door. Delivery time has been extenuated. That's also a part of, and you can see it in the supply chain and inventories. You increase your inventories to account for supply chain challenges. So we'll continue to see elevated inventories for this reason. By the way, that does suck up cash. You're holding inventory. You're not making money on that inventory when it sits with you. That's why just-in-time is really important to manufacturing. But these are all elements of the downturn in the economy and the lack of the supply chain to catch up. I don't expect these things to change much in the future. Prices paid are higher. It's being reflected both in inflation as well as prices received. This is actually good news for manufacturers that they can actually get the prices they need, because you know, their raw materials are going up. If that would be inverted, you'd have prices paid is higher, but prices received would not be going up. That would cause significant economic stress for the firms themselves. The number of employees, as you saw, took a significant uptick. Now, as we're coming out of the pandemic, it continues to rise, and there's lots of work, literally tens of thousands of jobs throughout the state of New York open in the manufacturing sector. What happens when you have a lot of open jobs? People have to work more overtime. So the work week has expanded. The future looking indicators are really important. General business conditions remain very favorable, as well as new orders and shipments. So manufacturers are expecting, unless this recent crisis becomes much broader and much deeper and longer, of course, right now conditions look very favorable. So I'd like to talk a little bit about manufacturing. I think it's important to get a sense of what is manufacturing today. How is it different than the past? And what will we be looking for in our community? We can see the future, I always tell people. I can see it my members right now. Every modern technology is somewhere in my manufacturing. Maybe not all be used at this moment, but they're somewhere in one of my members or throughout the state of New York. The other thing that's changing is where people prefer, how they prefer to work. Now, this is not as true for manufacturers who need production employees at the site. But reality is, the way in which people work in the service sector, you know, my office, for example, which was 99% on site, now on any one day, about half the team is working in the office. The average person works 2 to 3 days in the office. And I would expect most of that to hold true for the future. What's happened, of course, is employees prefer the flexible work style. And they actually do believe that hybrid is the future. You know, and what's interesting is, before the pandemic, 62% actually preferred fully on site, and that has shrunken to 37%. There are certain individuals on my team that spend every day in the office. They prefer to be in the office. Others, I've asked them to be in the office because of both service delivery and performance, to be in the office 2 days, as much as 3 days a week for some of them, if it makes sense, but they're able to really craft their own schedules, because like I'm doing right now, they can work from anywhere. Interesting enough, you don't see a huge push for fully remote. It's about the same number pre-pandemic as post-pandemic. This is a McKinsey study that was done more recently. What is not kept up, of course, is the C-suite executives are not as enamored with the work from home or a hybrid approach. That is, it's seen some shift, but it's not still the majority prefer that people spend over 4 days in the office. That's changing, but it's a more slow evolution. And a lot of mid-managers, we do a lot of training with mid-level managers and C-suite managers. And the challenge is managing and leading remote work or hybrid work. It's harder to do from a sense of it's, you can't really see what people are doing. I could walk around the office before and see my employees, talk to them, get a sense of their morale and so forth. It's harder to do that in a remote environment. So that's shifting, but actual leaders are still working their way into this changed work model. The other thing that I continue to remind people is just how important vaccinations are to the overall health of both our manufacturing sector and generally our community. If you look at really what happens with COVID once people are immunized, its severity and its death and significant severe consequences go down dramatically. We led a coalition, in fact, put one together immediately when COVID happened. We informed the state government of what we were going to be using to keep people safe. Most of those became the rules for New York State around manufacturing. And you saw very low spread rates. We actually tracked it within manufacturers. So we were successful in that. So you get a sense in the first part of COVID, about 45% of employees work remotely. That's down to about 15% now, as most of them come back and work in person. And yet significantly less difference in terms of spread rate. And manufacturers do have some unique advantages. Typically, they can spread people out. And they can take these safety precautions. They also are a safety-focused organization. You can't afford in a high-tech manufacturing facility not to be focused on safety. So they have all these unique advantages when it comes to fighting things like COVID. So these are just some of the technology advancements that are occurring as I speak right now in manufacturers. Not all of them are in every manufacturer, but every one of these is in at least one or more of my manufacturers. Everything from wearables, unmanned forklift trucks, cobots, computer vision, production. These are really all the high-tech ways in which products are manufactured today. Clean rooms are more likely to be in our manufacturer today than something you would see in the 1930s or 1950s. What's caused all that? Of course, we all know it's the rapid connectivity of things, actually, not just people, things. You know, and by 2025, 50 billion things will all be connected. Now, of course, that has its own concerns, like cybersecurity concerns. And by the way, that's one of the other threats, is that we'll likely see an increase in cybersecurity threats due to the conflict. Russia is a primary actor in that space. But we'll continue to see things dramatically being connected, and of course, people throughout the globe. What are the top trends in manufacturing today? Workforce is tech savvy, a lot of high skills. Apprenticeships, we're working hard on apprenticeships because you need to continue to skill and upskill. Cybersecurity being a big concern because of so much going on with robotics, so much going on with the use of data, analytics, AI, machine learning, all to improve manufacturing operations. A big trend is reshoring and increasing a focus on made in the USA. It will significantly change our supply chain challenges, and also is better for the environment not to transport things across the globe in order to serve products to people right here. We still have the largest economy. We consume a lot. Unfortunately, we have to import a lot. And that has significant environmental as well as economic and national security implications. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. What are the leaders investing in? Interesting enough, some of the ones that you would expect, like customer connectivity, given our highly digital world today, that's a big, big thing for them. They're trying to reinvent their supply chain. Why? Because it's costing them more than ever, and they just can't get the necessary parts to finish their products. That's one of the big problems with cars today. I have an example with my family. We ordered a car. It's a high-end automobile, and it came without automatic seats. So the reality is the customer didn't take delivery of the vehicle. The number of computer chips that go in a car today is astronomical. By the way, chip just about in everything today, probably your toaster. Talent and culture is becoming increasingly important to investment. People have an option of where they want to work. That's why the remote working, the flexible work schedules, all those things add to your ability to recruit and retain people. What are they investing in post-pandemic? High-tech areas. A lot of robotics, 5G networking, wireless connectivity, digital security. These are all the things. And it depends on industry sector, where industrial machinery is different, for example, where their 5G network infrastructure is a lower investment space than electronics, obviously, where 5G is really the next generation. It's what we'll be using. You'll see a lot of additive manufacturing going on. So new way of making things, you actually print. If you had to, it's layered and printed, and the complexity and the usefulness of additive manufacturing is becoming quite pervasive throughout industry today. Aerospace is one of the biggest users of additive manufacturing, but you're going to see that continue to grow throughout all the manufacturers throughout the world and of course, in our country. When it comes to competitiveness, when it comes to the size of manufacturing sectors, this will give you a sense just where things are made today. And you'll notice you don't see Russia. Russia does not have a significant manufacturing capacity of high tech and high skilled intensive manufacturing. When it comes to its exports, it primarily uses its and consumes its own. But China, obviously, US and Germany are the largest exporting countries in the world, followed by places like South Korea, even Taiwan and Japan. So this is sort of what is important. But right now, if you look at all the competitiveness indicators, the US is one of the most competitive places to make a product anywhere in the world. And that's despite having higher labor costs in general, because our labor costs are moderated due to use of technology. So there's a significant case for reshoring. At one time, the unit cost for labor really drove production overseas. That's not what's driving cost anymore. It's technology, it's capital. It's the ability to be quick to the customer's needs and demands. And the labor cost in China, for example, is significantly higher and growing. And they're actually having labor shortages as well. So it's much more cost competitive to do it in the US. The other things that will have to be watched, of course, is fuel cost. China is investing heavily in, I would, you know, they're doing some green investment, but they're literally building, they're the only really developed country in the world that's building coal plants, and lots of them. They need a lot of energy, and they're building a lot of, I would call it not green energy. So there's a lot of reasons why we'd want to reshore, but labor costs, in a dramatic increase of labor cost in China, is just one of them. So essentially, the US has a lot of advantages. The total cost of ownership actually is one of the best in the US because of our high innovation, high productivity. Productivity rate is up high single digits again in the last year. We have a highly skilled workforce. And of course, one of the advantages with the markets here, we have a much shorter supply chain, which is becoming even more important as we go forward with the disruptive supply chains, and no real hope of getting them back to where they were in terms of its total competitiveness. The key for every manufacturer, I would say for every industry, is every job is changing, and they won't stop changing. This is why SU and all learning institutions and all other ways of learning will continue to be front and center for competitiveness. It is not a job that won't continue to change. To include my job, I will say I do not have the same job I had 20 years ago. So what's going on specific to manufacturing? Well, with computing power dramatically coming down in cost and a lot of change, just a record rate of change across multiple sectors. In fact, what's happening is there's a blend of sectors even within manufacturing, where the biomedical chip production are blended into new industries, new opportunities. And this is very disruptive. So you see a lot of new players that will come on board, as well as expanded acquisition of these new players into the future. Now, specific to manufacturing and its workforce, several things are causing a lack of employees. First of all, there's a lot of baby boomers who are retiring, and that will only continue as they get older and want to enjoy life beyond work. The challenge, of course, is the shortage of qualified labor goes down. The skilled trades, technicians, there just aren't enough of them, and they're very difficult to find. Also, the skill sets continue to change. They're much more advanced. That's one of the reasons why we focus on apprenticeships and upskilling as a core capacity for us. STEM careers are on the rise, and I would make the argument that every career in the future will be a STEM career. You have some element of science, technology, engineering, and math. STEAM is also an incredible opportunity because the STEAM school focuses on creativity. One of the number one things that employers want is creativity. So we won't forget the arts because they're important maturers and developers of creativity. Another big challenge for manufacturing is the perceived attractiveness or lack of attractiveness of manufacturing. We need to do a better job of educating parents and students. We actually have a program now provides a product for elementary school parents and their children to start to understand STEM careers and the impact of that has on our future in manufacturing. And just to give you some basic understandings, manufacturing has the highest tenure of workers, almost 10 years. It has the lowest employee turnover, about 2.3%. Highest average wages, over $80,000, and more than three quarters of the R&D private sector is in manufacturing, which bodes well for the future, both growth and opportunity. And just a sort of a brief understanding of what we do as an organization. We do about 400 events a year. We serve about 5,000 individuals in a variety of ways. Our most, over the COVID period, we shifted all of our instruction and all of our networking to virtual, and we'll stay there as well as add back in our in-person events. We do a significant amount of manufacturing. In fact, we do about, we have about half of our staff now just worked on filling pipelines for workforce and also getting people into jobs. We do a lot of member services directly to companies both here and throughout the state, and we're the state's voice for manufacturing when it comes to manufacturing. We do a lot of work with both our federal and state representatives, the administration, and the agencies, all on behalf of members. So I'll stop there and take questions. I think there are a few in the chat, and I'm willing to stick around and continue to answer questions. I don't have to run off anywhere. So if you have questions or comments, I'd love to hear them.
Thank you, Randy. That was incredibly helpful. We do have some questions for you. Randy, what do you see as the future of unions in the manufacturing sector?
So actually, union participation and penetration primarily depends on industry. Traditionally, industries that have unions, trades, construction has a lot of unionization. You have a sort of traditional metal manufacturing, much higher unionization. They tend to remain unionized. High-tech firms start out, tend to be non-unionized. I expect that to be the same. Don't see a lot of changes specifically in the private sector unionization. We work with both union and non-union companies as members. Obviously, a high rate of unionization in the public sector. But it's been pretty stable over time. I would expect it to stay stable.
How can industries work in partnership with manufacturers to help CNY grow and develop?
Yeah, the challenge, of course, there are things with policy that we're working on, having a favorable tax policy that makes us competitive because it is a global market for manufacturing. But one of the key elements is having enough skilled workers. So working with the entire community, both in exposing individuals to the jobs that are here and potential jobs that could come here. Probably you've all heard about the potential of landing a significant chip fab. If we do that, that could be a big increase in the number of skilled workers we'll need. And the biggest challenge will be having enough people to fill those positions. We'll need to attract people as well as to have greater numbers of individuals coming from our school, our high schools, our colleges, into manufacturing. The nice thing about manufacturing, you literally can start right out of high school or with a certification, and the employers will pay for all of your education when it comes to upskilling. And the typical apprenticeship that we're servicing now, and we're the leader in apprenticeships in New York State, it will start at, start around the $15, $17 range, but within a year and a half be at $25 to $30 an hour with benefits. So it's a really quick, without any debt, by the way. So there's a lot of significant opportunity in the tech sector, manufacturing related, for the future. So we need to get the word out. We need students to take STEM courses, a lot of math and science while they're in high school, obviously starting before high school. That's true probably for any career into the future. So we need to work in partnership as a community to get individuals to move into these high paying jobs. And by the way, if you have the workforce, the companies will come. The number one thing companies are looking for is a skilled workforce today. So all things being equal, if we solve the problem with around skilled workforce, we'll come out ahead.
Thank you. What is the percentage of military manufacturing?
So we do have a meaningful amount of companies that do military manufacturing here in our community. It's not the bulk of our manufacturing. It tends to be in the detection system space, radars, Lockheed Martin, known for its wide array of radars. We have actually a radar or in data analytics sector in our community. Interesting thing about industry, they like the cluster. So if you get a significant players, you'll have clusters of supply chain, and they actually feed on each other. They recruit talent and they actually hire between each other. We would call it stealing or taking, but that's really great for employees, right? You have the ability to move from one company to the next company, and you're willing to move to our community because maybe you work for SRC and 5 years from now, you work for Lockheed Martin. So that gives us a robust when it comes to a robust economy, when it comes to supply chain. What we need to do is have more individuals who are in those spaces, but we do want clusters of companies. In military, primarily from the detection standpoint, we do some other production in the plastics sector or the metal sector, chip. We do some chip manufacturing. Some of those things are important. But the reality is we're not heavily dependent on military manufacturing.
Thank you. How are manufacturers in CNY collaborating with our local universities?
There's lots of ways. Obviously, the talent that comes from the local universities is absolutely critical. There is a, you know, over time, it continues to be more and more work on the sort of the research side, but it really is primarily in the talent space. The nice thing about New York State and our community is just a significant number of higher ed. We have some of the best higher ed systems anywhere in the country, SUNY being the largest public higher ed system in the country, bigger than Cal, actually. And the reality is that's the opportunity. We have a lot of higher ed. The key will be sort of, I think, blending both the educational components of higher ed with the hands-on skills that companies need. They need people who are skilled in use of those techniques. And that's sort of the future, is building more of the skilled upskilling into the degree programming, which is something we like to see. We're working directly with SUNY, doing a lot of work with SUNY Poly. We work with community colleges throughout the state as well, which is obviously a part of the tech skill set. So more work can be done there. Also, we need to capture the exiting veterans coming from Fort Drum, the Reserve, the Guard. So these are all initiatives we've got underway to get them into high tech careers.
Thank you. What are our strategic advantages in Central New York?
Well, we talked some about them already. I would say we have a very favorable lifestyle. you can actually count in minutes by miles versus some places have a much more dense and difficult traffic patterns. We have a significant and robust education system, both at all levels of education, and they're of very high quality. We have it's actually a wonderful place to live, a lot of opportunities to do things and close, logistically close, as well as, you know, travel time close to major metropolitan areas and areas of people, which allow us access to both talent and the ability for us to travel. I have, I've got daughters that are spread within 5 hours from here in Philadelphia, Boston. You can get to New York City easily, you can go to Toronto. So these are all advantages that we have. We also have the outdoors, and people love the outdoors, summertime or wintertime. So I think we have a lot of strategic advantages related to Central New York. We're one of the top places actually for small businesses and entrepreneurs in the country now. And I think that's a change. It's happened over the last 10 to 15 years. One of the strategic advantages that doesn't show up always on a chart is the ability for people to work together. You know, the county executive and the mayor work very well together, work very well with Albany. So that political leadership and business leadership and community leadership all working together to solve our problems together, that's a strategic advantage, because there will always be the next community challenge. There will always be the next world challenge. And can we come together to work on them? That's a strategic advantage that I think we have, and I've watched that evolve, and we've gotten better at it over the last 20 years that I've been at MACNE. So I'm pretty pleased with the way we're able to work together to solve our problems.
Thank you, Randy. A question here, is Amazon Fulfillment Center in Liverpool considered a manufacturing site?
Oh, they most definitely are. You've been inside there, you've seen the robotics, it's pretty phenomenal. And those distribution centers are increasingly high tech. And that's true of our members too, when they have inventory systems. Literally, they're stacked inventory systems. You literally punch a number, your part comes to you. So the reality is these are highly sophisticated distribution centers with high-tech futures. So yeah, I put it in the manufacturing category. Maybe it's a distribution, but it's connected to manufacturing, to be precise.
Thank you. Referenced truck issues and truck drivers. What is the response, are you aware of, that people are planning to? How are we going to respond to that need?
Yeah, in the short term, we're just going to have to train a lot more individuals and make those jobs more appealing to get truck drivers to go into that profession. The pay is increasing, but it's not necessarily an easy lifestyle. You spend nights away from home unless you're doing short haul. Part of the long-term future is self-driving trucks. Which are, by the way, they're already on the roads. They're just not in New York State generally, but they're, you know, so self-driving trucks will lower the long-term problem in the short term, we're just going to have to train a lot more truck drivers. And you can see the magnitude of it is quite severe. The other way is to lower the need when it comes to supply chain, move things closer to final distribution and production, which is part of our advocacy efforts to get more made in the U.S., made more in New York, so they don't have to use as much trucking resources.
Thank you. What do you see as potential collaboration for training and retraining unskilled workers between MACNE and various industries?
So what we have is access to the supply of jobs. We literally have a current talent platform that at any one time has hundreds of job openings. Across the state, there are thousands. We also are able to collect resumes and upload those to, I think we have about 10,000 individuals looking for jobs throughout the state of New York. That's just in our current talent platform alone. We're also able to do assessments. That is, a lot of basic assessments can be done, and individuals who haven't worked in careers can work, move into those careers. So I think that the tools that sort of the data AI exists for companies now to better assess and understand. What's also going on is companies are changing their parameters. They used to use something called, you know, they would use a degree to ascertain someone's ability to fulfill a need. That's going away. Less and less companies are requiring bachelor's degrees or associate's degrees or degrees of any kind. If you can demonstrate you can do the job or you can learn into the job, which is an apprenticeship approach, people are hiring you. The key is, of course, to match up at least entry-level skills, basic skills with entry-level opportunities. But there are really no entry-level jobs long-term anymore. Quickly, you move into higher paid and higher skilled jobs within 6 months to a year. It's not years that you're in an entry-level job anymore. So those higher skills are going to be critical. That's one of the things that colleges do really well, critical thinking, giving people the opportunity to learn, be more diverse. So there'll always be a place for the variety of types of learning. And I think the key is that we better connected also to groups like CNY Works, better connected to social services agency. We're starting a new program we call On-Ramps to Manufacturing, work directly with the social services organizations that have individuals that would like to have jobs, and then we're doing assessments. And we believe the key to changing sort of the dynamics of that is to do some quick upskilling preparation, and then they get hired. What changes, the whole dynamic changes when someone actually has a job versus training for a job. It's the same thing when it comes to all kinds of learning. Once you have a job, you're other motivated to be successful. So we're encouraging employers to do minimal requirements, hire, upskill. I think that's where the opportunity in the future will be with higher ed as well, is certifications, mini certifications, stackable certifications as people are already employed, because people just can't afford not to be employed, especially if you don't have the economic means. You have to go get a job. And how do you do both? Be in school, be learning, and have a job. That's one of the big barriers. I will tell you, our community is ahead of the curve on doing a few things, working on childcare. We have the Early Childhood Alliance, which is ahead of the curve, really a national opportunity. So when it comes to individuals who are not employed right now, dealing with their barriers becomes even more important than ever.
Thank you. That was incredibly helpful. Thank you for understanding that. That's great for helping our understanding. I think the other question we had just was regarding, talk a little bit more about China as far as it pertains to their, you said that's the country to watch in the future. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, the reason why China is so much different than Russia is its economic power strength and its people, you know, with this large number of individuals. They also have a controlled economy, and they can literally not just threaten us specifically with a military force, but which, by the way, is a very blunt instrument. You can't really use your military force. It's more of a deterrent. It's more of a threat than it is actual usage. We found that out ourselves when we were in Afghanistan, sort of the Soviet Union. So it's really, it's a blunt instrument. What's more important and actually more useful to evaluate is an economy. And China's economy has quickly become the second largest economy and will likely overtake the U.S. economy in the not too distant future. That gives them the economic strength necessary. Should they choose to do military action, they could, but they wouldn't want to. They would use their economic ties to the world in order to get their strategic outcomes. So the reality is we would prefer their democracy. They're not, which means that they are able to take actions that democracies generally aren't. Even Russia, even Putin's understanding that Russia, the Russian population only has so much patience, but he has many more tools to stay in power that wouldn't be possible in a state, in a country that's, you know, a true democracy. So our concerns are really around human rights issues. It's around who controls the overall direction of the world. Those are things we got to watch. And I mentioned Taiwan being a specific security issue because of its, because the world has allowed the Taiwanese to become the home of high-end chips, which really run our economy and run our security forces. So China in particular is our biggest threat. And that's one of the reasons why we have to really focus on China. We thought if we invited them into the WTO, that they would become more moderate, that they would not have human rights abuses, that they would become more democratic. Unfortunately, there'd been some moderation there, but that has not been their track. So I think we have to be particularly concerned about the long-term vision and work with China. We don't want to be antagonistic, but at the same time, their values are not our values. And I think we need to understand that as both economically and from a national security standpoint. I will say the most important thing for a country is not its size of its military. Though you have to have large militaries to deter bullies like Putin. That's why NATO is so critical. That's why other countries want to join NATO. That's why Germany is going to increase its military spending, because you have to have some way to stop someone from, you know, using their military force. But having said that, the most important thing is a very strong economy and a stable economy. And that's the one thing the Chinese are fighting hard for. They want to, they need enough jobs to employ the sheer number of people that they have in China. But they have their own challenges. We should know that. But the country to watch in the future won't be Russia. Who knows? This may be Putin's last stand. He may not be able to sustain this type of activity because of his own people won't want to do this. But China is the country to watch.
Randy, thank you so much. Our time is coming to an end. I just would like to thank you for sharing your expertise and knowledge and informing all of us about what's happening. I also like to thank the audience today for joining us and taking time out of your busy schedules. Please join us next Thursday when we will have Dr. Brian Conkle. He is the Dean of Hendricks Chapel. If you are interested, you can see our presentations are recorded and available for viewing at the Office of Community Engagement video channel page. The forums are also recorded through a partnership with WCNY Radio, and the audio versions can be found on WCNY's Thursday Morning Roundtable webpage. I want to thank you so much, particularly our speaker again, Randy Wolkin. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks, everyone. Hope to see you in person, not too distant future. Take care.
Thank you.